Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
With calls for new gun laws following the movie theater massacre, we begin today with how both sides distort history in the gun rights versus gun control debate. With us is Adam Winkler, constitutional law professor at UCLA and the author of Gunfight, The Battle Over the Right to Bear Arms in America. He also had a great Atlantic Magazine article last September called The Secret History of Guns and has a new article on Daily Beast titled Why Don't Mass Shootings Lead to Gun Control? Adam, thanks very much for coming on. Welcome to WNYC.
Thanks for having me.
Let's begin with this piece of history. The Founding Fathers, you remind us, required gun ownership in a kind of individual mandate of its time. How did that work?
Well, that's right. I mean, we think of the individual mandate in President Obama's health care law as so controversial. And opponents said, what power could Congress have to force people to buy something? But the Founding Fathers had something very much like it, only it applied to guns. You know, at the time, we didn't have a standing army, so we relied on a citizen's militia. And Congress passed a law in 1792 requiring all free men of a certain age to outfit themselves with a military-style firearm, whether they liked it or not.
And yet you also write that as part of that system, the Founding Fathers instituted gun restrictions that were so intrusive that the NRA would not support the Founding Fathers for office today. Ha! Huh. What were those restrictions?
Well, you know, we think of gun control as a modern 20th century invention, but nothing could be further from the truth. We've had gun control since the birth of America, and the Founding Fathers had gun restrictions. They barred large portions of the population from possessing guns, including slaves, but also free blacks, and even free white men who opposed the revolution. If you weren't willing to swear an oath of loyalty to the revolution, you could be disarmed. I'm not talking about traitors. I'm just talking about law-abiding citizens who were exercising their freedom of speech to argue that the revolution was not a great idea.
But those pieces of history would seem to argue for more universal gun rights, because if the government is going to make decisions based on racial discrimination and political favoritism regarding who can own a gun, well, we don't want that.
Well, we absolutely don't want that, and we shouldn't mimic the exact gun laws that the Founding Fathers had. I think my point is rather that in the founding era, the founders didn't see the Second Amendment as a libertarian license for anyone to have any gun anywhere they wanted. They balanced gun rights with what they thought was necessary for public safety. I think we fundamentally disagree with some of the things they thought was necessary for public safety. We have our own public safety concerns, and it's perfectly legitimate for us to take those into account despite the Second Amendment.
And under that system, under which people were required to own guns to be ready to join militias, there was also gun registration, which would be such a bête noire of the NRA today, right?
That's right. The founders had severe militia laws that required gun owners to appear at public gatherings where they and their guns would be inspected and, as you say, even registered on public rolls. There was even times where they went and did door-to-door surveys of every house to find out where the guns were, not because they were afraid the criminals would get their hands on them, but they needed to know where those guns were in the event of some kind of conflict with the native tribes or England or France.
What happened to that system, by the way?
Well, the militia system just fell apart, largely because of the War of 1812. It turned out to be a disastrous war. You might recall from your history classes that the British managed to burn down Washington, D.C., in part because states would not send their local militia troops to go fight in the battle, leading Americans to realize that they really did need a standing army.
Adam Winkler, gun historian. We can take your phone calls for him at 212-433-WNYC. We'll spend some time on this and get up to the present with Mayor Bloomberg versus the NRA. What will his 12-year legacy of fighting this battle be? 212-433-9692. Or post a comment or a question to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehr Show, as some people with strong opinions about guns are already doing. You mentioned the ban on slaves and free blacks owning guns at that time. And like it or not, race seems to play a big role in the perception of guns and gun laws throughout U.S. history. For example, you write about the 1960s gun rights debate between the Black Panthers on the one hand and Governor Ronald Reagan on the other hand. Can you tell us the Huey Newton versus Ronald Reagan story?
Well, sure. One of the most disturbing things I found in doing my research for Gunfight was that race and racism has really affected gun and gun control laws ever since the founding era. One of the ways in which we kept African Americans and other racial minorities as second-class citizens was by denying them the access to defend themselves. And so what happened was in the 1960s, the Black Panthers became a radical organization, and in an incident that many people forget, but it was big news at the time, they literally invaded the California state capitol with loaded rifles, pistols, and shotguns. They weren't there to do any violence, but they were there to protest a gun control law that was being considered in the state of California. And even California's conservative governor, Ronald Reagan, came out in support of that gun control law. And in fact, Ronald Reagan helped make California's gun control laws the strictest in the nation.
You quote Reagan telling reporters that he saw, quote, no reason why on the street today a citizen should be carrying loaded weapons. And he said a gun control bill at the time was a reaction to the Black Panthers' legal arming of themselves in public, and that it, quote, would work no hardship on the honest citizen. So was that all about race?
Well, I don't think it was all about race. It was also about concerns about public safety. The Black Panthers were walking around Oakland with openly displayed firearms, and that caused people to be very concerned. Remember that this time period, though, there were serious racial problems in America. In 1967, we saw the worst race riots in American history. Detroit and Newark were practically burned to the ground. And this pushed Congress to pass the Gun Control Act of 1968, which a gun control supporter at the time, not a gun rights supporter, a gun control supporter said at the time, if you looked closely at the law, you'd have to conclude it wasn't really designed to control guns, but more likely to control blacks with guns.
The NRA, as an organization, you write about how it originally supported and even proposed early gun control laws, including a three-point law proposed around 1930 by the president of the NRA, Carl Frederick.
That's right. The NRA was not always the diehard, no compromises opponent of gun control that we know today. In the 1920s and 30s, the NRA was at the forefront of the gun control movement, drafting restrictive gun control laws and promoting them in state after state. When Congress was considering the first major federal gun control law, the president of the NRA was asked whether it violated the Second Amendment, and his answer from the perspective of today is simply astounding. He said, I have not given it any study from that point of view. And indeed, if you look at the NRA's signature publication, American Rifleman, they never even mentioned the Second Amendment in the 1930s and 40s and 50s. Look at it today, however, and you'll see the Second Amendment mentioned on almost every page.
The NRA changed its stripes in the 1970s. What happened?
Well, there was a change literally overnight. In 1977, there was a revolt of hardliners in the gun rights movement that took over the NRA. The NRA at the time had endorsed the Gun Control Act of 1968, and the leadership was pretty moderate and was even planning on retreating from political activity, moving the headquarters to Colorado Springs so they can focus on outdoors activities. This enraged a group of hardliners who really thought guns were not about hunting ducks, but about protecting yourself in a time of rising crime rates. And the hardliners staged a coup at the annual membership meeting, and when the sun rose the next day, the entire leadership of the NRA had been replaced with hardliners who were committed to fighting gun control.
And you write that the white NRA leaders at that time shared some of the politics of the Black Panthers, particularly their distrust of law enforcement. How did mostly Southern and Western white rural conservatives and the urban Black Panthers wind up with some common ground on that?
It's so funny because if you think about it, it was a series of gun control laws passed in the late 1960s that were designed to disarm the Black Panthers and radical rioters in places like Detroit and Newark, laws that were designed to restrict access to guns by urban, black, leftist radicals that sparked a backlash among white rural conservatives who became convinced that the next step for the government was to come and get their guns too.
Huh. And so the first presidential candidate that the NRA ever endorsed was Ronald Reagan in 1980. Had Reagan changed his tune on guns after his standoff with the Black Panthers?
Absolutely. Ronald Reagan was nothing if not a wise and sage political calculator, and he understood that the rise of the new right movement in the late 1970s would propel him or could propel him to the White House. And once he was in office, remember, he was shot in 1981, right after he took office, and his answer was, we don't need new gun control. He, along with so many of the new hardliners of the NRA, thought that gun control was just another piece of evidence of failed big government policies.
So this distrust of law enforcement, this fear of government, whether it comes from the Black Panthers or white right-wingers, tell me if you think that's echoed in this call we got on the show just yesterday when we were talking about gun control law proposals and, you know, in light of the Colorado incident. This is a caller named Scott in Soho, and he says he's for the public having military-type weapons just in case of government tyranny. Listen.
I know that sounds kind of crazy, but it's happened all over the world. In Russia, how many people were killed during the Bolshevik Revolution? In Germany, when they rounded up all the Jews to go ahead and exterminate them, I mean, they didn't have any way to defend themselves. In China, they've done that, where they just walk in and say, hey, we're taking over. And that's what the real reason for the Second Amendment is.
That's the real reason for the Second Amendment. So constitutionally, as a constitutional law professor, what's your thought on that? And culturally and socially, put Scott in the context of gun rights defenders today.
Well, I think his views are very commonly held among the gun rights people that I spoke to in researching Gunfight. I found that view everywhere across the country, people saying that they were fearful of the government and thought that they needed to have guns to protect against government tyranny. I'm not so confident that you could prevent government tyranny with individual arms, but nonetheless, I think that it is far removed from what the Supreme Court said in 2008. In 2008, the Supreme Court for the first time held that the Second Amendment protected a right of individuals to have guns. And the Supreme Court said in that case that right was about personal self-defense in the home against criminals. It was not a right to grab your guns and, because you don't like Barack Obama, decide you're going to have a revolution.
By the way, remind us about that 2008 Supreme Court ruling. If they determined for the first time that the right to bear arms is purely individual, what happened to the first clause of the Second Amendment that says, in order to establish a well-regulated militia?
That's right. The Second Amendment has been profoundly confusing to Americans for 200 years because of the two clauses and the number of commas in there. It's almost like James Madison just discovered the comma and wanted to have as many of them in that phrase as he could have. In the gun rights community, there is no doubt that the Second Amendment protects an individual right to bear arms. And the standard definition of the first, or way of understanding the first clause, and was repeated by the Supreme Court, was that we the people are the militia. And so when the Second Amendment says there's a well-regulated militia, it's referring to the citizens who could grab their guns, be ready to fight in an instant like the Minutemen of the Revolutionary Era.
We will continue in a minute with Adam Winkler, constitutional law professor at UCLA and author of Gunfight, The Battle Over the Right to Bear Arms in America. Some of the fascinating history of how he says both sides in the gun rights debate distort history today. He's actually written a whole book with that history. And now we'll bring it up more to the present in light of Colorado. We'll talk about Mayor Bloomberg's 10-year-plus battle with the NRA and if he's ever won a battle with the NRA over anything. And we'll take some of your calls on the history and current state of this debate with Adam Winkler. Stay with us. Brian Lehrer on WNYC with historian and UCLA constitutional law professor Adam Winkler, author of Gunfight, The Battle Over the Right to Bear Arms in America. And how about these little pieces of history, Adam? This is Mayor Bloomberg on CBS Face the Nation on Sunday, reminding us of two little factoids.
You know, Governor Romney, when he was governor of Massachusetts, actually passed a ban on assault weapons. And President Obama, when he came into office in 2008, said he would reinstitute the federal ban on assault weapons.
Adam, were you aware of both of those things, including that Romney, he said passed, I presume he means signed, as governor, a ban on assault weapons?
I'm aware of it, and what's remarkable is how far they've come since then, which is, but neither presidential candidate is going to support reauthorization of the assault weapons ban that expired a few years ago in 2004. I don't think we're likely to see any new gun control laws passed in the wake of this tragic Aurora shooting.
Why not? What gives the NRA so much power? Let me play another clip of Bloomberg in which he exhorts people to take this issue seriously on behalf of, if nobody else, police officers. Listen.
I don't understand why the police officers across this country don't stand up collectively and say, we're going to go on strike. We're not going to protect you unless you, the public, through your legislature, do what's required to keep us safe. The only reason to have an armor-piercing bullet is to go through a bullet-resistant vest. The only people that wear bullet-resistant vests are our police officers. And that's true across this whole country. So we should, at some point, we have to understand this is our children or grandchildren or us. But for the police officers, it's much more immediate because when you and I hear shots, we run away. They run towards it.
Guns. The union representative.
Mayor Bloomberg on CNN on Piers Morgan last night. So, Adam Winkler, where do police officers come down historically in this gun rights versus gun control debate?
Well, historically, the police were often aligned with the NRA, in part because the NRA is the leading marksmanship training organization in America. And so when a new police officer came on, he went to the NRA to get trained how to use his firearm. However, there has been a big split between the NRA and police officers in more recent years, in part because of the NRA's refusal to support a ban on the so-called cop killer bullets that Mayor Bloomberg referred to in that interview. However, what I've found in speaking to police officers in my research for Gunfight is that a lot of police officers think that gun control is an important issue, but they don't think it's going to make a big difference in their lives, that the people who they deal with that have guns that are the most dangerous people are the people they feel are not obeying the law no matter what. And given how many guns there are in America, 280 million guns on America's streets today, they feel that a new gun control law that, say, bars assault weapons probably isn't going to do much to protect them.
Let's take some phone calls. Michael in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Michael.
Hi. It's a pleasure to be on your show.
Pleasure to have you.
So my point was, you know, kind of in response to the comment you played earlier about, you know, the point of the Second Amendment is for, quote, law-abiding citizens to be able to arm themselves against the tyranny of the government. Our government currently outspends the next 26 militaries on Earth combined. If they want you out, you're out. I mean, even an assault rifle and a big stone wall is not really going to protect you. And I feel like it's, you know, I hear that argument a lot, which I think is ridiculous. And the other one I hear a lot is kind of the slippery slope argument that a government that's going to take away our assault rifles is going to be taking away our Swiss Army knives next. That we, you know, nobody will have a weapon and no law-abiding citizen will be able to protect themselves. And I think both are just specious and they're ridiculous.
How about that ragtag army that overthrew the British Empire in the 1700s?
That's great. We're still talking about people who were using, you know, muzzle loaders and lobbing cannonballs at each other, not predator drones and sophisticated surveillance equipment. You know, just about every square inch of New York City is currently being under, you know, is pretty much under video surveillance. If the government wants you, you're gone.
Michael, thank you for your call. Alex in Jamaica, you're on WNYC. Hi, Alex.
Hello. Love the show. Just wanted to say I'm actually a resident of Massachusetts, and I have a concealed carry permit in Massachusetts. And people often think Massachusetts is a very liberal state, but it was easier to get a license there than it was in Kentucky, where I lived for a brief period of time. And in both places, but especially in Massachusetts, nobody uses their concealed weapon for criminal activity. There's a very, very low rate of that. And I was just wondering if your guest could discuss their concealed carry permit and the ability of law-abiding gun owners to have guns without committing crimes, as opposed to non-law-abiding gun owners, especially in places like New York and Boston and Chicago.
Adam Winkler, go ahead.
Oh, well, you know, there has been a big controversy in the academic literature about the effectiveness of concealed carry laws. There have been some studies, most famously the More Guns, Less Crime studies of John Lott, that have found a decrease in crime in areas where we allow permissive concealed carry laws, where we allow people to carry guns freely. There's been contrary studies that seem to show the opposite. I think one of the things that comes clear, though, is that the major concern that gun control advocates have with concealed carry laws, that they're going to lead to huge spikes in criminal violence and in minor arguments ending up in shootouts, there's really no evidence to support that idea. We don't see increases in crime from concealed carry holders, in part because, and it's not that surprising, is that those are the people who are obeying the law, who are doing what they're supposed to be doing. They're like 99% of the gun owners in America. They're not the ones we need to worry about. We need to worry about when the guns get in the hands of the criminal element and the people who are not so law-abiding.
But there are also accidents that happen. There was just a story the other day of a cop in upstate New York who shot and killed his own son, his adult son, in a hotel in Old Forge up in the Adirondacks because he mistook his own son for an intruder. It was apparently an honest mistake. And this guy had a gun because he's a police officer, so he was able to have his gun on him. And when he thought his hotel room was being intruded upon, he opened fire, and it turned out that he killed his 37-year-old son. And I wonder if there are stats on, you know, in a society where there's a proliferation of guns among the innocent, whether more gunfights break out in bars, whether there are more accidental shootings like these, things like that.
Well, no doubt when 35% of households have firearms in them, we're more likely to have accidents in which someone shoots someone accidentally or improperly, or when they're cleaning a gun, we're going to have an accident. You're not going to have that in Japan where they don't have firearms in civilian hands. That's definitely one of the costs of having the right to bear arms. Now, that might lead some people to decide we need to get rid of the right to bear arms. That's a fair point of view, I think. But it is like almost all our constitutional rights. It poses dangers when we have the right not to incriminate yourself or the right to be free from unreasonable searches and seizures. All of those things allow criminals to go free and then commit their crimes again on other people. Those are some of the downsides of having these constitutional rights, but we should factor that into our determination about whether we want a particular constitutional right.
Jackie in Manhattan wants to continue the concealed weapons discussion. Jackie, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you so much. My name is Jackie Hilliam. I'm the executive director of New Yorkers Against Gun Violence, and I just really wanted to take issue with what your guest just said about concealed carry permit holders being law-abiding citizens. I mean, I think if you go to the center of the Violence Policy Center, you'll see that there are many, many evidences of people who have CCW permits who've gone on to commit crimes. And in fact, the state regulation of CCW permit holders is so weak that the state of Florida alone issued 1,600 CCW permits to known felons. There is no real national database. There's no way to make that a national system. And in fact, if you look at the numbers, New York State has about 70,000 CCW permit holders, and the state of Florida has 500,000. The state of, I think, Texas has 650,000. And right now the NRA is pushing to make all of those CCW permit holders available for travel throughout the United States with their guns. I think it's a nightmare, you know, another nightmare waiting to happen in a city like New York, where we have very carefully constructed our gun policies.
Jackie, thank you for your call. And Adam Winkler, would you agree and you know, confirm that the NRA works against restrictions on gun possession, even among the mentally ill and felons?
Well, the NRA says they do not. However, they do not necessarily support laws that would do more to keep guns out of the hands of felons and the mentally ill. For instance, we have a terrible background check system that only captures about 60% of lawful gun sales. We should have background checks for every single gun sale. And the caller was absolutely right. I didn't mean to say that every person who has a concealed carry permit is law-abiding. But if you have those hundreds of thousands of people in a state like Florida who have concealed carry permits, the question is, what percentage of them turn to criminal activity as compared to the larger population? There's always going to be some criminals in a group of 600,000 people. The question is, are they overwhelmingly criminals? Are there things that we can do to prevent them from getting their hands on those permits? There's no doubt our concealed carry permitting process is flawed in America.
By the way, Jackie, as a gun control advocate, let me ask you something that kind of previews a guest later in the show. We have a federal judge coming on who writes in a new book that that he has trouble getting gun convictions, even here in New York City, because gun ownership, even illegal gun ownership, is so popular among jurors. Does that surprise you?
Well, I mean, the availability of guns in New York City is very, very well known. 9 out of 10 guns that are traced in crime come from sales in other states. So it's not surprising that everyone, including criminals, has access to guns illegally. And I think therein lies the problem, because New York's gun laws are very safe and very sensible, but when it comes to all the other states flooding all those hundreds of millions of guns that your guest just talked about, they're coming to places like New York and California that have good gun laws.
And Jackie, thank you. But Adam Winkler, the point that I think Judge Frederick Bach is going to make here in a little while is that even among law-abiding jurors, the idea of having guns for self-defense in New York, even illegally obtained guns, is quite popular. Does it surprise you? Because we think of this as kind of an urban versus rural culture clash.
Right, and you know, it's one of the big misunderstandings about guns in America. We think it's really about people in the cities tend to think that it's really just about a rural cultural thing, that someone who's given a gun by their father at the age of 10 on their first hunting trip is never going to give up that gun because it represents their heritage and their culture. But I think one of the real heart of the gun rights movement today are not hunters or people who receive their guns from their dad on a hunting trip, but rather urban people who feel that they need to have a gun for self-protection against criminals. And if it's hard to take the gun out of the hands of the kid who got it from his father, imagine how hard it is to take it out of the hands of someone who lives in New York, who lives in an area where there's a relatively high crime rate, and who feels that they might not survive the night if they don't have their gun to defend themselves. That's why so many people in New York have guns, despite the fact that it's illegal.
So after 10 years in office, with less than 2 years to go, has Mayor Bloomberg accomplished anything on this score?
Well, it was very interesting. Mayor Bloomberg came out the other day and said the problem is that we have a failure of leadership in the gun control community. Now, it's somewhat ironic because I think of Mayor Bloomberg as the leader of the gun control movement, but I don't think that it's really his failure. I think actually the gun control movement doesn't need more leaders. It needs more followers. Unfortunately for the gun control groups, gun control gains a lot of support in polls, but people don't go vote for gun control advocates. They don't give their money to gun control organizations, all of which these days are financially struggling, some of which are going out of business because they don't have the intensity of support that the right to bear arms pro-gun people have. And so I think the real problem is not leadership. The problem is that the voters are not turning out on this issue and really supporting candidates who support gun control. And that's why gun control is not doing well in America.
You call Mayor Bloomberg the leader of the gun control movement. He's certainly out front. But mayors generally share his views, don't they? The Conference of Mayors holds the positions that Mayor Bloomberg is out front articulating.
Well, we often find the biggest support for gun control among urban mayors because, in part, they're dealing with the problems of gun crime in
right.
their cities.
So we have mayors concerned with public safety versus Congress and their own state legislatures.
That's right, and in a lot of these states, and especially in rural areas where there's really no gun problem to speak of, except when there's some high-profile shooting like we saw in Aurora, it's hard to get elected officials to come out strongly in support of gun control.
So Aurora may not change anything. Do you think Trayvon Martin will change anything with respect to those so-called stand-your-ground laws?
You know, it doesn't seem to have done much so far. Apparently, there were some states that were considering adopting new stand your ground restrictions and have decided not to. I don't think the problem, personally, I don't think the problem is the stand your ground law so much, although there's some problems with it. The real problem is that for years, no one had guns on the streets in America because it was illegal to carry concealed weapons. And so you were allowed in places like California to stand your ground for over 100 years. However, when you stood your ground, you didn't use deadly force because you didn't carry a gun. Today, people who are trying to stand their ground and defend themselves are more likely to be armed, and we're more likely to see more Trayvon Martin-like incidents.
Adam Winkler, constitutional law professor at UCLA and the author of Gunfight, The Battle Over the Right to Bear Arms in America. He also has a piece on Daily Beast called Why Don't Mass Shootings Lead to Gun Control? Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC coming up next, Remembering Sally Ride.